Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Well, welcome along to Unbelievable. It is the first show of the new year. I hope you enjoyed last week's show. I'm Justin Brierley, and last week we had sort of quite a varied array of different pieces that I brought to you. But back to the normal format this week of a discussion, but in a sense different from our normal format, more of a round table discussion today. As we look at something which, yes, well, harks back to Christmas, but I'm going to give you my excuse for why I've saved it for the first week of January in the new year. This is Unbelievable, the program that gets Christians and non-Christians talking here on Premier Radio.
You're unbelievable.
Well, today on the show, we're looking at the Star of Bethlehem. We're asking, is there scientific proof for it? Well, joining me from the States today, Dr. Hugh Ross, a Christian astrophysicist, as well as Jeff Zwierink, who are both part of the organization Reasons to Believe. Also joining us in the conversation today will be Mark Kidger, who's an astronomer based out in Spain and author of The Star of Bethlehem, An Astronomer's View. And here in the studio in London, Norman Backrack, who's an atheist and part of the Ethical Society. No stranger to this programme, he's been on a few times in the past. And he's been thinking about Christmas and the stories around Christmas, especially in this context, the Star of Bethlehem and the visit of the Magi. And so we'll be interested to hear his views as we go on through the course of today's programme. Hope you enjoy what promises to be a very interesting show. Well, first of all, let me say a big thank you to all of those who are joining us at somewhat of an international show today on Unbelievable. Firstly, greetings to Hugh and Jeff, who join us from Reasons to Believe out on the west coast of America. Hugh, let me introduce you first of all. Tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, because you've been studying the stars for quite some time, haven't you?
Yes, I have. I'm a Canadian. I was born, raised, and educated in Canada. Got my PhD in astronomy at the University of Toronto, and then came to the U.S. to continue research at Caltech. And while at Caltech, I got involved in a church. They put me on their pastoral staff, and a few years later, they helped me launch Reasons to Believe, which is a science faith think tank. We're a group of research scientists that are looking at the frontiers of scientific research to develop new evidences for the Christian faith. And Jeff, you just joined us. You've been with us like...
Just over 6 years.
6 years.
And Jeff, what's your area of speciality, if you like?
I'm a physicist who does astronomy, so I've got a PhD in astrophysics, a bachelor's in physics, graduated from Iowa State back in 1997, have done a number of postdocs, and I'm employed full-time at Reasons to Believe. I also have a part-time research faculty position at UCLA, where I'm currently working on an experiment trying to find dark matter. So,
Sounds interesting. How, Jeff, firstly with you, how does your faith play into your science? Lots of people are trying to paint science at war with faith in some sense. You obviously don't see it that way.
No, I've those are the two things that I can recall from earliest in my life is that, one, my family's a Christian family who has, church and growing and knowing Christ and, worshiping and serving him has been an integral part of the way I was raised and part of my livelihood. My dad's a PhD chemist. And so these two areas of science and Christianity have just been an integral part of my life from as young as I can remember. I see them both complementary and mutually reinforcing of one another. Because I'm a Christian, I want to do my science well. As I understand the science and learn how to study, I understand and gain a much deeper appreciation of who God is and what he's done. So I see them working together. I don't see them being in conflict.
And I'm a little different. I was not raised in a Christian home. In fact, I didn't meet Christians till I came to Caltech. But it was through my astronomy and reading a Gideon Bible that I became a Christian at age 19.
And Hugh, did you kind of come into conflict at that point between points of faith and points of science? And have you had to, as it were, resolve those in the course of your life?
Well, it was my astronomy that persuaded me that the Big Bang explanation for the origin of the universe was correct. And that told me there had to be a beginning for the universe and therefore a beginning. I came to that realization at age 16 and 17, and then began to look at the different religions of the world. And it became quite obvious that the truth was not in Hinduism or Buddhism or Islam a number of other religions I checked out. And finally, I began to go through a Gideon Bible. I realized that the Bible had taught Big Bang cosmology thousands of years before any astronomer dreamed of the concept. And after spending 2 years scrutinizing the Bible, realized this is a book that was free of any provable scientific error and made many predictions of future scientific discoveries. And that persuaded me that this book must indeed be inspired by the one that created the universe. And that's what motivated me to sign my name in the back of that Bible, giving my life to the creator of the universe.
And extremely widespread sort of ministry you have now, doing conferences, obviously podcasts, articles and things that relate to issues of science and faith. And the last time you were on this program for the first time was over a year ago, responding to the statements of Stephen Hawking in regard to whether recent scientific breakthroughs have eliminated the need for God as a creator of the universe. But today we're looking at the Star of Bethlehem, and it seemed appropriate in that context to bring on another guest who's joining us by phone from Spain, Mark Kidger. Mark, thank you for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. Thanks very much for inviting me.
You're welcome. I don't think you come with any sort of particularly strong faith background, Mark, though you describe yourself as an agnostic. But what got you interested in the Star of Bethlehem, that particular aspect of the Christmas story in particular?
Well, it actually dates right back to my childhood. I can remember getting up early one morning. It was Christmas Day, beautiful clear sky. I lived in a village outside Bristol where at that time artificial lights didn't stop you seeing the sky, and I saw the moon, I saw Venus in the dawn sky together. Absolutely spectacular sight, and that just got me thinking, and it set the germ of an idea about the Star of Bethlehem that has just continued and continued and continued throughout my life. When I started to work professionally in science, I had opportunities to study that I'd never had before, and the Star of Bethlehem is one of the things that I have kept coming back to since I started at university.
Well, we'll hear in more detail what your studies led you to believe about the Star of Bethlehem a little later on. I mean, you do, as a day job, as it were, you look at the stars, don't you? I mean, does it leave you with a sense of awe, a sense of wonder at the universe and its properties?
Nobody who looks at the night sky, up dark, full of stars, cannot feel a sense of awe. I've been very lucky that I've worked in some of the best observatories in the world, and I've been able to look at the sky in its most glorious splendor. You cannot look at it without a sense of awe. And now I'm working for the European Space Agency. I'm working for an observatory that we've got in space, the Herschel Space Observatory, which is the biggest telescope that's ever been put into space. So I don't look through a telescope any longer, but the sense of awe at the universe remains exactly the same.
Wonderful stuff. Obviously, it's great to have three astronomers and physicists on the show today. Never had that many astronomers all combining. A non-astronomer also joins us, though, Norman Bachrach, who's more of a, I would say, an interested observer and coming in to sort of lend your view on the Christmas story and this Bethlehem star, etc., Norman. You're an atheist, Norman, and what do you make of the story generally? Do you see the whole Christmas story as something of a myth, a fabrication? Where do you come from on Christmas?
Well, I am a skeptic. I've always been very skeptical. I can remember my parents were also rather skeptical. I was not brought up to believe in any religion. So I naturally think very skeptically about this story. I actually think that in those days, back 2,000 years ago, this is more to do with astrology rather than astronomy. And perhaps we ought to have some astrologers on the panel, because in those days, for example, there were Gnostics, the people who knew things, G for K, Gnostics. They believed the stars corresponded to earthly events. So the three wise men might have been a reference to the three stars in the belt of Orion. Taurus the bull, overlooking the hunter Orion in the constellations, may be a clue to the ox in the stable. And Ursa Major, Ursa is a bear, but according to the Egyptians, it was an ass. So perhaps references to ox, ass, and so on could be astrological references.
That's a very interesting theory. I mean, diving straight in there with a way of perhaps reinterpreting where the Christmas story may have come from. But before we get into any more detail on that fascinating issue, Norman, I should say, just for those who are confused and wondering why on earth is Justin doing a Christmas show in the first week of January, I do have a good excuse. Firstly, it's just interesting anyway, this Star of Bethlehem business. But of course, Christmas actually starts, strictly speaking, on Christmas Day. And people have sort of forgotten that, I think. The fact that actually Christmas is a 12-day period starting Christmas Day and finishing, of course, with the Feast of the Epiphany, which was yesterday, Friday, the 5th of Friday, the 6th, I should say, of January. Tomorrow is the Epiphany Sunday. And of course, that is the day when we remember the visit of the Magi, the Star of Bethlehem and that whole story. So there's my excuse and I'm sticking to it.
Justin, can I chip in here? This is Norman chipping in.
Yes.
You say it starts with Christmas Day, but just tell me, because I don't know, how old do you reckon Mary was when she gave birth to Jesus? I mean, she was pretty young.
Good question. Good question.
Shall we have a guess? 16 or something like that?
Around that, 14, 16, something
okay.
like that.
Okay. Well, I would say that the Christmas has got to start 16 years ago, before that, because there was something very special about the birth of Mary, at least according to many Christian traditions. She was an immaculate.
Well, that all depends, doesn't it, on which Christian tradition you're relying on.
The point of that is this immaculate conception, she was born in that way so that she didn't have sin, and presumably that was so important to one. So you could even say, this is the point, really, even if you don't like the tradition, God plans it all out. I want to know whether your three religious people believe in a deterministic universe. Last atom is precisely determined. So God knew 16 years later that Jesus would be born.
That's a very interesting sidetrack, but we'll get to that in a moment. Let me just say, before we go back to our other guests, that if you want to have your say and respond to anything you hear on the programme today, you're welcome to email in. It's unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and look forward to hearing your thoughts via our Facebook and Twitter accounts. You can find them at the Unbelievable Facebook, at the Unbelievable webpage, premier.org.uk/unbelievable, and we'll be hearing some of your responses to the last few weeks of programming towards the end of today's show.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Right, heard quite a lot there from Norman, Hugh and Jeff. if we get time to get to some of those interesting questions about whether we live in a deterministic universe and all the rest of it, we might get time later on. But let's hear, first of all, at the outset, your case for the Star of Bethlehem. I think a lot of people will assume that the Star of Bethlehem is in some sense a story that we take on faith. But the interesting thing about astronomy, of course, is that it's something that you can kind of rewind back, as it were, to see what events were happening some 2,000 years ago in the night sky. And there are all kinds of sort of theories put forward as to what the Star of Bethlehem may or may not have been. So tell us about those theories and what you think is the best contender for what might have been happening when the Star of Bethlehem appeared to the Magi.
Well, I think you made a good point there, is that Matthew 2 is the only written account that we have from that time of the Star of Bethlehem. There's no corroborating evidence from any other text or from any other scientific discovery, with the exception of maybe a sighting of a nova in China in 5 BC in April or March. I mean, that's basically it. So the real question is the account we see in Matthew 2 scientifically credible? Yeah, and this is why Jeff and I have written and done some DVDs on this subject showing, yes, there are credible scientific explanations to the text that we see here.
Well, you know, I would think it would be worth pointing out that oftentimes, I think especially in Christian circles, is there's this idea that the star was just something unmistakable in the sky and that everybody would have seen it and, you know, something just so brilliant that it would catch everybody's attention. And what's interesting is when you go and you start looking at the biblical accounts, you find that Herod and the folks in Jerusalem and Judea and in the Israeli region had no clue or didn't notice anything about it. There was something kind of unique to the Magi that they would have been particularly looking, or I guess to say it this way, that it's probably a much more subtle event that requires somebody who's looking for events in the heavens, whether they be doing what we would call astrology today or not, that it's not this just kind of broad, universal, everybody's going to notice type thing. In fact, that's Herod's response is, tell me when you saw it, because they hadn't seen it in Jerusalem, or at least hadn't noticed it.
And the shepherds hadn't either. So, I mean,
and I guess we should be wary of taking too much of our cues from what we've kind of invented culturally today as the Christmas story of a star hanging over a stable. In some sense, you know, that's probably what most people think of from their children's school play or something like that. And that's not actually what the Bible says is happening, you're saying.
Well, that's right. I mean, in fact, a lot of the English translations give you the impression that the star was kind of guiding or pointing the way to where Joseph and Mary lived. And that's not the case. The Greek verb there is histeme, and it means, this is the full definition, to cause or make to stand, to appoint, to place, to put, set, make firm, establish, to cause something or someone to keep its place. And so really what we're having communicated here is this is an object in the sky that's fixed in the sky. So that's why I take the position that it actually is a star. It's not a planet or, an occultation by the moon. Those are bodies that would move relative to the background stars. Given this Greek verb histeme, it indicates this would be an actual star that would be fixed in its position relative to the background stars.
I mean, let's hear. I mean, one of the theories that has been quite popular of late is the idea that perhaps what the wise men saw was the conjunction of two planets. I think Jupiter and Regulus, I think, possibly. And that's been put forward as possibly a neat interpretation of as it were, an event in the night sky that would have happened near the time that appears to be, we're talking about.
Well, yeah, I think the conjunction was actually Jupiter and Venus, and it just happened to be around Regulus. I know there's a very popular DVD in the United States by Rick Larson that makes that argument.
And what do you make of that argument? Why don't you personally go with that?
Well, the Greek verb aster is always showing up, or now, pardon me, the word is translated star. It's in the singular. So it seems to suggest that we're not looking at two objects, but a single object. Now, some have made the point, like Rick Larson, that you've got Jupiter and Venus actually coming so close together in 2 BC that they would appear as a single star. But notice that the text says that the star reappears. It's a star that appears, disappears, and reappears probably about a year and a half, maybe a little bit more later, because you got Herod inquiring about the star that they had seen in the east, and based on that, slaughters all the boys in Bethlehem in the vicinity that are 2 years of age and under, indicating that there's a time separation between the first appearance of the star and the second appearance of the star, and, you know, it's the same star. So when you're looking at conjunctions of planets, you don't find them appearing the same way, separated by that time period. Moreover, it's always in the singular. It's not in the plural. And also, I'd argue this can't be a supernova, because a supernova, number one, everybody would have noticed it, and number two, it doesn't recur.
So just before we go to some other views from our other guests, what do you kind of come down on it being then, if it's appearing, disappearing, and reappearing? What kind of an event in the night sky could that be?
Well, a recurring nova would fit that explanation, because being a nova would be something that wouldn't be so spectacular everybody would have picked up on it, but it's also a fairly rare event. In other words, a bright nova in the sky. What I mean by a bright nova is something that may be equivalent to the brightness of, say, the star Polaris, second or third magnitude, and therefore this would be something that would be picked up only by somebody who's watching the sky. Relatively rare event, novae that bright occur about once a decade. And the thing about the magi is that word magi is wise men, and it's a transliteration from the Persian term for the wise men that you see referred to in the book of Daniel. Daniel was the chief of the wise men. His three compatriots were called wise men. And it's Daniel that prophesies the date of the coming of the Messiah. It's the only place in the Bible that gives you a prediction of when the Messiah would arrive. You know, it's 483 years after the issuing of a decree to rebuild Jerusalem, and that would put the coming of the Messiah at about 5 B.C. So in other words, these magi in the East, if they were familiar with the writings of the greatest of the wise men, namely Daniel, would have been aware of the approximate time, would have been watching the sky, looking for something relatively rare. A nova would fit that description. And also, there's a very small percentage of nova, about 1% of nova, that we call recurring nova. They will explode and become bright, disappear, and have the capability of exploding again. And it would be the same star showing the same position in the sky in the same way. And many recurring nova do indeed recur with a period of about a year and a half to 2 years. So that would fit the text.
Right.
Now, of course, I'm not saying this is proof. I'm just saying this would be consistent with everything we see recorded in Matthew chapter 2.
You hold this tentatively, obviously. Let's go to Mark Kidger. Mark, what conclusion did you draw then in your book, The Star of Bethlehem? You looked at similar theories to Hugh and Jeff, I think, didn't you?
Okay, well, I came to a quite similar conclusion, although by a slightly different route. And before talking about that, though, I'd just like to make a couple of observations.
Please do.
So, one thing, is it true that Matthew is our only reference to the Star of Bethlehem? Certainly there is a clear reference, and with, to a certain degree, different information in the Apocryphal Bible, the Apocryphal Gospel of James.
Hmm.
Now, we don't know when that was written. Was it written before Matthew, after Matthew? Did James take from Matthew? Did Matthew take from James? It's difficult to date it. But it's a very interesting account.
Mm.
Wasn't incorporated in the Bible as we know it in Nicaea, but the account does exist, and it's written as a first-hand account. Another comment that I'd make is you did mention this very, very spectacular conjunction of Venus and Jupiter.
Mm.
In fact, there were two of them, one in 2 BC, one in 3 BC. Now, they would have been incredibly spectacular. Seen from Babylon, the Babylonian astronomers would not have seen the two planets probably come together, you'd have seen that best from the United States rather from the Middle East. However, you have one small problem with this. Now, if you accept the five-year error in the calendar from Dionysius's calendar, that does take you to 5 BC for the nativity.
Yes, the birth of Christ is...
Herod is reckoned probably to have died in 4 BC. So if you've got an event that occurred in either 3 BC or in 2 BC, sounds like it's a little bit late to me.
Yes, indeed. This is the main issue with the if you like, the theory of the planets coming together. It doesn't fit the dates that we appear to have from the Bible. Herod obviously was alive at the time that these men visited. He died 4 BC, we understand, but these planetary events were 3 and 2 BC, hence falling after he had died. Hugh, is that another reason why you would personally reject the planetary hypothesis?
Well, that and the fact that it's just too spectacular. Everybody would have been familiar with it, and the Matthew text makes it quite clear that Herod, the religious leaders in Jerusalem, were oblivious of the event. They hadn't noticed it. I mean, that conjunction of Jupiter and Venus, where they come very close together, that would have been something everybody would have been familiar with. The shepherds were oblivious. So, yeah, we would discount that for several reasons. And as you mentioned, the date doesn't seem to fit either. And moreover, as Mark points out, they really don't come together as a single object. They only come together for about an hour. And so outside of that, unless you're looking at it at the right time, you would not see it as a single object. Moreover, the text tells us it reappears, and the conjunction in 3 BC is quite a bit wider than the conjunction you see in 2 BC, and there's only 10 months separating them.
Well, you've heard the astronomers and the science there, Norman. What do you make of it? Does it sound like a plausible hypothesis to you as a sort of layman?
So far, I have not heard anything at all convincing. I think that there's quite a number of points, I think, that need to be made. First, as I was saying, that people in those days believed that every VIP, every very important person, when they were born, they had to have their special sign. Even the North Korean leader, coming right up to date, he had two rainbows seen when born. Mind you, there are always two rainbows if you look for them. The birth of Buddha to the Virgin Maya was signalled to local wise men by an unusual star, as was the birth of Krishna. So what I'm saying here is, this is why I'm sceptical of the whole story. It's just that if you were going to be important, you had to have some spectacular cosmic signal of your importance in those days. But my real complaint about our astronomers here, they're very good astronomers, I'm certain. By the way, they should know that in Genesis, after creating the sun for our daytime light and the moon for our nighttime light and the planets, it says God made the stars also. So your main subject of cosmology, which is 99.999 recurring percent of the universe, is just an also-ran from the point of view of the biblical writers. They weren't concerned with any of that stuff. Now, my real point is this. I think you're all missing the point. To try to find, by modern calculations, an astronomical event, it could be a nova, a planetary conjunction, a comet, whatever, which occurred at the time as part of the regular motions of the stars. You're trying to show why, looking up your calculations, there was indeed, as part of the regular motions of the stars, an interesting new star or some event. The point, surely the whole point is, it had to be a supernatural, not a natural event. It was specially concocted as an exceptional phenomenon.
Okay, I understand where you're going with this. We are going to have to take a break now, and I'm sorry to cut in on you, but we'll pick up from where you left off and see what Hugh, Jeff, and indeed Mark have to say in response to those several points that you made there, Norman. You're listening to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, this Saturday afternoon. As we look at the question, is there scientific proof for the Star of Bethlehem? It is, of course, the Feast of the Epiphany, when we remember in the church the visit of the Magi and the Star of Bethlehem. So more from our scientists and our sceptic in just a moment's time here on the show that aims to get you thinking unbelievable.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon. Fascinating topic today. Is there scientific proof for the Star of Bethlehem? Here on the show that gets Christians and non-Christians talking. Obviously, Christmas has been and gone, but it's only just been and gone if you think about it. The 12 days after Christmas Day are really the Christmas period. The Feast of the Epiphany tomorrow in churches. I don't know how many actually mark it that significantly, but it's a time when traditionally the visit of the Magi to the infant child is remembered, the Star of Bethlehem. We Three Kings of Orient are, and all the rest of it. So today we've got coming on the line from the States, Dr. Hugh Ross and Jeff Zwierink from Reasons to Believe, both physicists and astrophysicists in that US Science and Faith organization. They've done some interesting research into whether there is astronomical proof for the Star of Bethlehem. Same goes for Mark Kidger, whose book The Star of Bethlehem, An Astronomer's View, came out, I think, at the end of the 90s. But coming first to you, Hugh and Jeff, in that last section, Norman, our atheist, saying, frankly, the whole story smells fishy. Every significant religious figure had some kind of a cosmic, you know, event to herald their arrival. This looks like the same thing. What's your response to that?
There was one comment I would make is that in some sense, the Bible holds itself to a little bit higher standard than that. While there may be people who have said, okay, you know, we're going to make up and kind of make up stories, the Bible makes a claim, at least as Christians have understood it, that it does, where it's describing events, that those events actually happen. And so you read those events, and they're written as though they actually happen. And so I think it is somewhat incumbent upon the Christian to go and say, okay, if these are events, is at least reasonable to believe that they happen. I don't think we can come down and say, okay, this is definitively the story of what happened here. I just don't think we have enough data to do that. But we can find a number of plausible explanations for what this star might have been and what the Magi and what the shepherds actually saw in the sky that would have drawn them given the context in which they lived. And so I think the fact that there are kind of a number of plausible explanations for what might have happened, some each have their own strengths and weaknesses, does lend at least credence to the idea that this is an actual historical event.
Yeah, we're not claiming that there's astronomical proof that the events in Matthew 2 took place, but we are saying what we see described in Matthew 2 is scientifically and astronomically consistent.
So one of the things that Norman seemed to be suggesting towards the end of what he said there was that isn't this supposed to be a supernatural event anyway? Why are you even bothering to try and give it a natural explanation? I mean, if God wants to put a star in the sky, God can put a star in the sky. I mean, what do you make of that sort of point of view?
Well, but the text of Matthew 2 does indicate that it's a natural event. I mean, it uses this word aster, which refers to a body in the sky. So it's making it clear that it's some naturally occurring body in the sky that's responsible for what's taking place here. The Greek verb histemi tells us it's fixed relative to the background of stars. And notice you've got Herod saying, go and make a careful search for the child. So in other words, there's really no need for this star to guide the wise men to the location. Bethlehem is a small village. It wouldn't take them that long to find a firstborn son of a couple that's relatively young. I mean, they would know the approximate age of the child based on the star that they saw in the east. So this wouldn't be that difficult. That was Herod's understanding as well.
So why didn't Herod send his own troops along to get that child? Because we know he wanted to do that. Why did he say to the wise men, you go off and find him and come back and tell me where he is? That seems most implausible to me.
Well, I think, you know, keep in mind that it's not just three wise men. The text tells us that when the wise men arrived, that the entire city of Jerusalem was thrown into a stir. So this was a significant party. They had a lot of resources, and I think Herod knew the motivation of the Magi to find this child and to present gifts, and therefore he felt that they would be in a better position to find that child. And once he was certain of the child, then he could just simply dispatch of that one child instead of having to wipe out all the boys in the vicinity of Bethlehem. And the text also explains how it is that the child Jesus survived. You know, because of the events in Matthew 2, we have the child Jesus escaping to Egypt and then returning after Herod's death. So there's a real plausibility of the whole story in explaining the childhood of Jesus and his parents.
Let's just bring in Mark, and then I'll let you bring in your next point, Norman. Chomping at the bit there to say something. Mark Kidger, again, I think you wanted to weigh in on something Norman had said, and perhaps even on Hugh and Jeff. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, there are various things that I want to say. First thing to Norman is, it is not a matter of calculation. People who are not astronomers, not a scientist, have some idea that we're sat with crazy hairdos and lab coats peering at a computer screen and trying to work out what is happening in the world from some abstract display that a computer program has given us. In fact, it's nothing like that. Now, in the case of what the sky looked like 2,000 years ago, yes, there are many things we can calculate, but we also have chronicles. The Chinese were fantastic sky observers. They chronicled absolutely everything that they could see in the sky, sunspots, aurorae, comets, novae, supernovae, just about anything that could have any astrological interest whatsoever.
I think the question, Jeff,
we've got fantastically detailed Chinese chronicles
okay,
of the time.
I think the point of the story is that the star was meant to lead the wise men to Jesus. Now, my question to you and to any astronomer is, you know very well that a star high up in the sky cannot lead you to a particular spot because it's far too high up. As you walk along, even a few miles, you're not going to change the observed position of that star as far as you're concerned. And quite apart from that, after walking for a few hours, the whole sky is rotated, making you completely disoriented.
So congratulations, Norman, you've got exactly the right point.
Okay,
they
weren't walking for a few miles,
they were walking for about 1,800 kilometres.
Okay, I'm thinking
that would have taken 2 or 3 months,
okay.
And yes, the sky did rotate.
Hold on,
we were doing it.
There are two journeys, and there's the journey from the mysterious east, let's call it Baghdad. That's probably where they bought the gold, the frankincense and the myrrh at the local Al Tesco.
And was it?
Yeah, of course it was. Tesco is a common
enough.
Supermarket
I don't
in
think
this
that's
country.
Right, but anyway, continue.
Yeah,
Carry on.
There were special offers that week, and two for one. And being wise, they snapped up those special offers for the gold, the frankincense and the myrrh. The point is that they had that long journey to get all the way to Jerusalem, and they were led by the star. Now, all I'm saying is, if you've got a star up in the sky, it cannot lead you to a particular town. And then their second cleverer journey was using the star, the special star that took them from Jerusalem to Bethlehem. Now, we've been told it's easy to find a newborn king in the back streets of Bethlehem. My suggestion is this was a dark night. It was a cloudless sky. If you're in a stable, you've got no electric lighting. I doubt if there were many street lights in Bethlehem in those days. So therefore, it's pitch black, and everyone who's got any sense is tucked up in bed, fast asleep in their straw. So how are these wise men going to get and find? Okay, they called at the inn.
Okay.
They were told there was no room there. Go around the corner and look down the alleyways.
You're extrapolating a little bit here, Norman. let's hear what Mark has to say, then come back to Hugh and Jeff. Go ahead, Mark.
Okay, well, one thing is that Matthew says nothing about the star leading them from the east. That would assume that the star was visible in the west in the sky. Now,
No, they came from the East. They were wise men from the East. They obviously had to lead them west from Iraq or Persia across the desert of Iraq.
Well, let's allow Mark to respond. Yes, go ahead, Mark.
It doesn't actually say that at all. It says that it led them between Jerusalem and Bethlehem. Now, Bethlehem is due south of Jerusalem.
Second journey. We've got
and
two journeys here.
And if you had seen a star, for example, a nova, where the Chinese, we know, saw what appears to have been a quite bright nova, in the east in March, April, it was also seen by the Koreans, you calculate how long it would have taken them to travel over two deserts, mountain ranges, rivers, etc., to Jerusalem. You, being reasonably conservative, you would say at least 2 months to get there. Where would the star that was in the east 2 months before have been at dawn by May? It would have been in the south, directly south of Jerusalem, over Bethlehem, as they would have travelled on that road, which is only about 6 miles. So actually, all that Matthew is saying, if you take it literally, which maybe we shouldn't do, is that it was a perfectly natural event.
Mm.
Now, another thing...
The prophecy was that they had to find the newborn king in Bethlehem, and you have to make sure that's where they went. So they knew they had to go to Bethlehem. What they didn't know was...
And so then why did they go to Jerusalem?
I don't know that. They went to Jerusalem first.
I'd be interested to hear from Hugh and Jeff just on this point, at least, before we come back to you again, Mark. Thanks for that contribution. Hugh and Jeff, what's your take on this whole idea of the star leading the wise men? I mean, we referenced this a little bit up at the start.
I mean, if I could, I think it might be worth just actually reading what the text says, because there's a lot of things we're saying it says and doesn't say. And, I mean, there's really only a couple of verses. It says, Matthew 2, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born King of Jews? We have seen his star in the east and have come to worship him." And then later on in verse 9, "And when they had heard the king, they went on their way," the Magi, "and the star they had seen in the east went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed." And that's the extent of what's talked about the star.
Yeah, and where it says stop, it's the Greek word histeme, which has a very broad definition. As I've mentioned already, it's simply referring to the fixity of the object in the sky in the same position they would have seen in the east. And what the star did is indicate to the Magi the timing of the coming of the Messiah. It told them nothing about the location. And that's clear from the text, because they went to Jerusalem to inquire of the location. And it was the Jewish scribes and leaders, religious leaders, who said the book of Micah prophesies the location of the newborn king, that it would be Bethlehem. So the star did not tell them to go to Bethlehem. It was the religious leaders in Jerusalem that told them that they had to go to Bethlehem.
You're knocking on the head this idea of Normans that the star was the thing leading them to Bethlehem. That simply is a misunderstanding of the text as far as you're concerned.
It's a misunderstanding of the text. And it's also a misunderstanding that the Magi visited the stable. The star appeared. It disappeared. And when they were in Jerusalem, they found out that the location was Bethlehem. And notice that the text says that based on that information, it says that Herod inquired of them, "When did you see that star in the first time?" And based on that information, he slaughtered all the boys in Bethlehem 2 years of age and under, indicating that the Magi were visiting a toddler, not a newborn child. They were visiting Jesus when he was about a year and a half to 2 years of age.
I think you're going to have to change all those cribs all over the world who've got you.
That's one of the main points. So.
Now you're telling me he was 2 years old, running around.
Well, this is the whole point, though, isn't it, Norman, that we unfortunately do have kind of invented a Christmas of our own making in some ways with the shepherds and the wise men at the crib. crib. And, of course, that's not actually what the Bible says.
By the way, the crib was crib from the Egyptians. They loved making little models of people. You can see them in any museum's Egyptian gallery. That was taken over from the idea that there was a god Isis who had a virgin son, Horus. That was a very popular religion at the same time.
Well, yes, but a very odd thing for a Jewish person to incorporate into their religion nonetheless. Let's come back to you, Mark. Are you in accord essentially with Hugh and Jeff there on their kind of take on the reasoning behind why the wise men went to Jerusalem and then to Bethlehem, that essentially the star wasn't doing any leading, it was, as it were, just giving the timing, as it were,
agree with about 95% of what they said, which is good enough for me.
What's the 5% then?
So, the people have an idea of what the gospel texts say, and it tends to be a complete misunderstanding. It is also a mishmash of what is in Matthew, what is in Luke, which the two nativity stories only actually agree on the fact of the birth of Jesus, which is a bit unfortunate. And that's one of the problems with our nativity plays, that we get a false idea because people combine the two gospels. And Luke's gospel doesn't mention the star at all. Anyway, that's by the by. One thing that we haven't said so far, and I think is a very important thing to say, is that even though I, as an agnostic, and by that I don't mean an atheist without the courage of his convictions, I mean somebody who really does not know what to think and is prepared to be convinced one way or the other, you've got to remember that a lot of the information in the Gospels actually can be confirmed as historical fact. Other parts undoubtedly are not. We know Herod existed. We know Caesar Augustus existed. We know that Quirinius was, if not governor of Syria, he was governor's legate. We know that the temple existed. There are many monuments in Bethlehem and Jerusalem that have been discovered by archaeologists. So what you can't say is that there is no basis of fact in there whatsoever. The problem is to work out what parts you can believe and what parts are, shall we say, symbolic or religious and should be, I suppose Norman would say, taken with a grain of salt.
Well, let's go to Hugh and Jeff before we come back to Norman. Hugh and Jeff, what for you, why do you trust, as it were, in that sense, the story of the Magi? I mean, you've already given us an explanation of an astronomical event that would cohere with this story. What makes you take the story as a fact of history anyway, that wise men had this experience and did these things?
Well, I think Mark makes a good point that there's many statements within the Gospels that can be put to a scientific and historical test, and in each situation the Bible passes that test. So it gives us some confidence that those regions where we can't put it to that kind of a test, that we can nevertheless trust what it has to say, because it's proven to be completely trustworthy everywhere else we can put it to the test. And moreover, those places where we can't put it to a test, we can come to the conclusion that what it records is plausible. It's something that could have actually happened as it was recorded. There are no contradictions what we see recorded in the gospel accounts.
I suppose the only downside of the pulsating, I can't remember the proper scientific name for it, sorry, but the nova that kind of pulsates.
The recurring nova.
The recurring nova, that's right, is that is just, in a sense, a hypothesis, whereas I suppose the beauty of that, the conjunction of the planets thing, is that you can actually see that did happen at that time, because if you rewind the astronomical clock, as it were, you can get back to that conjunction at that point. Obviously, you don't think that can be the one, because, as you said before, it would be too obvious for everyone, and it actually falls outside the time dates we're looking for. So you've come to this conclusion that it was this pulsating nova, if anything,
That's at least consistent with what the text records. I mean, one problem with the conjunction of planets, these are relatively common events. I mean, they occur, you know, several times a year. So you need something that's going to be relatively rare and something that's not going to be picked up by the whole world's population.
How often, from a scientific point of view, do these pulsating novas occur then? I'm trying to gauge sort of how unusual an event this would have been had that been the explanation for these magi, these astrologers, to have seen it and taken notice of it and decided this is significant.
Well, a bright nova about once every decade, and 1% of nova would be recurring nova. So yeah, this would be a relatively rare event. And as Mark mentioned, the Chinese did record a nova in 5 BC.
And that would approximately fall around, in the right kind of time frame for what we're talking about.
Well, that would have been consistent with a first appearance. And if the recurrence was fainter than the first appearance, that would explain why the Chinese didn't record the second event and why the wise men would.
There are interesting things here that I think are worth noting.
Mm.
That Chinese nova occurred in the south of the constellation of Aquila, the north of Capricorn. The moon would have passed very, very close to it. So it would, in the natural manner of things, have disappeared for a few days as the moon passed close by. If it wasn't especially bright, if it was fading, the full moon would have hidden it away as well. It could have disappeared quite easily for 7-10 days between the time it first appeared and its re-sighting. So that's one thing that's worth bearing in mind.
I must ask you at this point, was that planned at the time of the Big Bang, that particular astronomical sign would be seen at the time of the birth of Jesus?
Well, I certainly didn't plan it, but
you didn't. But was it pure coincidence, or what are we to make of this story? You're now telling us these are just natural events that occurred anyway, or are they specially constructed supernatural events? And none of you have managed to come to grips with that.
That's a very interesting question.
Well, if I could make one comment, I think one of the difficulties in trying to figure out what is it that the wise men saw, or the magi saw, that would prompt them to make this big journey, is trying to understand what is it that the wise men were looking for, what is it that the magi were studying, and what would have been significant to them. I mean, I think we kind of look at this as we think, okay, we've got three wise men, the star hovering over a manger, pointing a beam down. There's all these imageries that we have here in 21st century Western culture that, we really have to ask the question, what is it that to the magi would have signified that something happened? And so I think that's probably the most difficult aspect in all of this. There are at least two different plausible astronomical events that we could posit that would have been relevant. But we really, I think trying to understand what was significant to the magi is really what's going to help resolve this, because we don't know.
If I could venture my own view on this as well, Norman, you seem to be requiring that either this was a special, as it were, miraculous event, in which case God would have done it. But if it just occurred naturally in the course of the universe, as it were, rolling out its astronomy, that then it doesn't count anymore as a special sign. But isn't the point that if an extraordinary phenomenal event occurs at a particular moment that's relevant, God could have planned it that way?
Well, that's the question I asked the astronomers, and none of them is prepared to say. Well, it was all planned.
I would disagree that we're not prepared to say. We were just discussing other things.
So. 14 billion years ago, the clockwork was set going.
Okay, let's put that at least.
That could be your position.
Let's put that to Hugh and Jeff now. So, Hugh and Jeff, do you think then, in that sense, what Norman's saying, that this was, as it were, mapped out from the start, that this astronomical event would happen at this precise time, and that was, in a sense, God's timing?
Well, God is free to perform miracles in a variety of ways. When he created the universe, he brought into existence matter, energy, space, and time out of nothing. That's a transcendent miracle. When Jesus walked on water, that was a transcendent miracle. But notice in the Bible, you see much more frequently God performing what I would call transformational miracles, where he takes naturally occurring events, but he controls them in such a way as to bring out the result that he wants. And, you know, he created the universe, recurring nova, or conjunctions happen all the time. It would be within God's prerogative to set up a particular natural event in such a way that it would catch the attention of the Magi and get them moving with their gifts to Bethlehem and save the child from extermination from Herod.
And I was going to say as well, I heard a theory not long ago that a scientist, a historian, had come up with the theory that the parting of the Red Sea was to do with the plates shifting at that moment and creating a walkway for the people to go through. Now, some people were saying, well, that shows that it wasn't a miracle. But in a sense, it's just as miraculous for that to happen at the very moment when the people are faced with a sea in front of them and an army coming on behind them. If it's just the fact that God arranged things to happen in that at that particular moment naturally, it's in a sense no less miraculous in some sense.
What's interesting about the example you just mentioned, and also has relevance for discussing the star and whether it's some transcendent miracle or a more within the laws of physics type miracle, is that when you go back and you read the passage of the parting of the Red Sea, there are normal occurrences that are used. In fact, God, the biblical text says that God used a wind to part the sea. And so that's a sign, or that's an indication that there are, that's a miracle worked within the confines or within the realm of the natural laws of physics. And so when we go and we look at the Bethlehem star accounts or the Christmas star accounts, we don't see that this is God placing a star in the heavens or God creating a light, that it was, there was a star that that prompted these magi to begin making this journey. And so it does appear that it's one of those miracles of timing, if you will, where God has something there that will precipitate the events that he wants to bring about.
We are going to take a quick break, and then we'll have time for your final thoughts, Norman. I know you've got your own theory there about what this star may or may not have been. So we'll come to that in a moment's time. Fascinating show. Is there scientific proof for the Star of Bethlehem? We've been asking today. Our guests on the line from the States, Dr. Hugh Ross and Jeff Zwierink from Reasons to Believe, both a physicist and astrophysicist. Mark Kidger, an astronomer based out in an observatory in Spain at the moment, author of The Star of Bethlehem, and our skeptic voicing his opinions here in the studio in London, Norman Backrack. You're listening to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. We'll be back in a moment's time as we conclude today's programme on the Star of Bethlehem. Welcome back to Unbelievable, the show that I like to say aims to get you thinking on Saturday afternoons here on Premier Christian Radio. And indeed, you may be listening online at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Welcome along, however you're listening, for this final part of today's show. And January is a time on Premier Christian Radio generally when we're looking at the theme of mind and soul, particularly mental health issues and how they affect Christians and our engagement with that area of science and psychology and that sort of thing. Well, on Unbelievable, we'll be taking that theme, if you like, on an intellectual, scientific footing, philosophical footing, particularly next week when I'm joined by Keith Ward, who's a high-profile Christian philosopher from Oxford and a proponent of what's called dualism. He believes that the mind and the body are separate things. There is a different substance, if you like, that forms the mind. And indeed, it's a good proof of the existence of God. Well, he'll be in conversation with atheist philosopher David Papineau, who believes in a physicalism. That is, that there is just the body which gives rise to this this concept of the mind. But that's going to be followed by other shows in the next couple of weeks as well on neuroscience. Has neuroscience killed God? And we'll even then be looking at things like the demonic activity and whether that is there are really malevolent spiritual forces at work in the world or whether these are simply psychological effects brought on by the human brain and that sort of thing. Well, looking forward to some really interesting programme in this area, so come back next week for the start of that with Keith Ward and David Papineau. And yes, looking forward to some interesting correspondence on that. Don't forget, we've got some of your correspondence coming up at the back of today's show after we've finished looking at today's topic.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, finishing up our discussion today on the Star of Bethlehem, again, let me reiterate, if you've just tuned in, it is, of course, post-Christmas now, but somewhat relevant because it's the Feast of the Epiphany tomorrow in churches around the country, and the time when the visit of the Magi is officially remembered in the church calendar. I'm sure you'll be hearing more from Hugh and Jeff and others and Reasons to Believe. Fascinating stuff they're doing out there in the States, and I'm sure we'll be bringing them on again in the future as well. And Mark Kidger has been joining us as well today, as alongside Norman Backrack. Details for all of these guys and more resources with the website premier.org.uk/unbelievable if you want to investigate more about this Star of Bethlehem for yourself. Okay, Norman, I think you've got your own theory there about what this star might or might not have
been. Yeah, I got a project for the scientific people over there around the world who want to give a scientific reason for the star. Ball lightning. That's a rare and mysterious phenomenon. A ball about the size of a football light bounces around, and God could have got that and used that to lead the wise men straight to the place in Bethlehem where he had to go. That's my suggestion. Mind you, a celestial sat-nav would have been just as good. Proceed forward 3 cubits, then turn left into the alley. It would boom. And that would be just a good way of leading them on.
Yeah, well, slightly facetious end there to your comments, Norman, but I know where you're coming from. Okay. Mark, coming back to you, ball lightning, Norman says. What about that? Did that figure at all in your investigations into the Star of Bethlehem?
Okay, well, there are about as many theories for the Star of Bethlehem published as there are for the death of the dinosaurs. I think the count is around about 70, and ball lightning is one of them, yes.
Okay. What's your thought on its... I mean, why did you discount that in your...
It really is very esoteric. It's something that very few people ever manage to observe directly, and a lot of the people who do observe it directly... have very unfortunate consequences from it. it's a bit surprising. It's like Norman suggesting that the Star of Bethlehem was actually a burning bush.
I mean, what I'm saying, I think what Mark's saying is it's equivalent to suggesting that it was a burning sort of.
Well, I must say I'm very disappointed that it's simply a star way up in the sky and not something just above them showing them the way.
Well,
you've spoiled all the magic and of the whole story.
Well, I'm sorry about that, Norman, to have robbed you of that childlike familiarity with the story. But I suppose your ball lightning suggestion would have at least given a sense of it being there in the sky above the stable. But from what Mark has said, it is a pretty unlikely scenario. And I think probably from what Jeff and Hugh have said, the Bible doesn't require us to believe it was in some sense hanging above the stable, as we've said. But Mark, in the final analysis, you also fell eventually to this theory of a pulsating star. That struck you as the most plausible one, especially given that there was this convergence with the Chinese astronomers noting something around 5 BC.
Yes, exactly. I think if the Star of Bethlehem really existed, if you want a scientific or a natural explanation for it, the nova that the Chinese and the Koreans saw in 5 BC is the way to go. However, one of the things about the Star of Bethlehem that we haven't pointed out is that it doesn't matter what your particular faith is. If you are a Christian and you want it to be a miracle, there's a light in the sky. If you're a scientist and you want it to be a natural event, you call it a nova. If you don't believe in it at all, you can say that this is just something that was added to the Bible as a nice story to make the birth of Jesus look particularly special. But the thing is, there is no particular reason why my own opinion should be better than anybody else's. My personal opinion is that if it existed, it was that nova. But I'm not going to say that if a Christian says it was a miracle that that nova exploded at the right moment, that he's wrong.
I'm not going to say that
if somebody says it was a perfectly natural event and a coincidence, that that person is wrong. Every person has to make up their own mind.
I mean, you've told us you're an agnostic, Mark. Doing the research for this, did it in any sense move you in the direction of thinking, this stuff hangs together fairly well, actually? Or did it not kind of bring you to any particular change in your view of Scripture and the person of Jesus Christ?
Well, one thing it did do for me is that looking into things, it was interesting to discover just how much of the gospel story is actually confirmed as historical fact. One of the things that I found most fascinating was to discover that in Bethlehem, there genuinely are shepherds out on the hills still today, 2,000 years later. That for me was a very nice touch to discover. It really, you know, if it's like it today, it's perfectly possible it was like that 2,000 years ago. And there are many things there that you can actually confirm as historical fact, or you know from direct observation, really did exist. So it was very interesting to me to discover just how much historical basis there is in the Gospels.
Well, thank you for joining us today, Mark. It's been fascinating to have you involved in this conversation. Thanks also to Hugh and Jeff, and I'll leave the final word with you guys. I mean, Mark there distinguished between those of faith who will then obviously see this as a miraculous sign, those who perhaps are just looking for a natural explanation. I suppose you're providing both in a way, aren't you, Hugh? A natural explanation, but it was a natural explanation that acted as a sign that the gospel writers saw as having an impact on the birth of Christ and his relevance to people.
Yeah, that's our position, that this is a credible account. We're not claiming we can prove that one explanation is better than another, but we are saying that what we know scientifically and astronomically demonstrating that the account in Matthew 2 is certainly a credible account. But I think we're missing the main point. The main point is that these wise men in the East had only one portion of Scripture available to them, namely the book of Daniel. But on a careful reading that book of Daniel, they were prepared to invest significant resources, time and energy and treasure, in seeking this newborn king. And after a year and a half of journeying, they finally came to him and presented their gifts and worshipped him. And I look at the Magi as an example of the kind of faith that all of us should demonstrate in our response to the written revelation that we've been given to us, in our response to worshiping the one that gave us his universe and the promise of the new creation.
It's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you as well, Jeff, for weighing in as well. And it's been great to have you both on. Thanks, Mark. Thanks, Norman.
Thank you.
A great discussion. And as I said earlier, if you'd like to find out more, both from the pen of Mark and also from Hugh and Jeff at Reasons to Believe, I'm going to post up the links to the various resources that they've produced. So go to the website premier.org.uk/Unbelievable. Also, relevant Christmas-themed podcasts from the past as well, taking in some of the aspects of other things that we touched upon, whether we can trust the stories, issues around the origins of Christmas as a sort of festivity, and all that kind of thing. All available from the website premier.org.uk/Unbelievable. Thank you for listening, and I'll be bringing some of your feedback to the last few weeks of programming and a little bit of what's coming up in 2012 for Unbelievable as well.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, what an interesting show. Looking forward to receiving some of your correspondence in regard to that. Though some people before this show aired had been getting in touch with me about their thoughts on the Star of Bethlehem and other things. So we'll read some of your emails now. And after a little break over the Christmas period, you've been emailing in on the last couple of shows, the New Year's show and the Christmas Eve show, when we were looking at the messianic prophecies and as regarding the birth of Christ and that sort of thing. Lovely email here from Giesler, who says, near the end of your second to last show, you announced that you had received a barrage of emails, and I found your enthusiastic delivery of this phrase to be utterly charming. The words a bevy, a barrage, have rattled around in my mind for the past few days, each time bringing a smile to my American face. You never do know when in ordinary speech you'll provide one of those bits of verbal ornamentation that make our world a brighter, more colourful place. I enjoy listening to the show from Salt Lake City, Utah. Do carry on. Thank you, Giesler. Glad to have ornamented your world a little bit last week. Now, here's someone who wanted to weigh in on the New Year's Eve show. We had a wide variety of things on that show. If you haven't picked it up yet, I encourage you to do so. Some interesting little features and interviews in there. This from Brian, though, who wants to give a small correction regarding Michael Brown. I read an email from someone asking whether Michael Brown, who appeared on the show before, was the same Michael Brown involved in the Brownsville revival. Well, you say someone had written in wondering that. You informed the listener that it was a different Michael Brown, but I'm 99% sure it is the same Michael Brown. I listen to his radio show all the time, and he's made numerous references to his involvement with that revival. You might want to check that out. A small matter, but I thought you might like to know. Well, others, Brian, have brought it to my attention as well on Twitter, etc. I was completely wrong. It is the one and the same Michael Brown. I was confused with names at the time and thought I was giving a factual account, but was mistaken. So thank you for clearing that up. Michael Brown, the same person who was regarded in some ways, as I understand it now, as the sort of theologian, if you like, of that Brownsville revival in Pensacola, Florida, over a decade ago, I think. Martin says, may I just point out, in regard to your New Year's episode, that the definition of a gentleman is one who can play the bagpipes but refrains from so doing. I gather you didn't like the bumper music we had on the show then, which was a bagpipe version of Auld Lang Syne. But Martin, don't worry, bagpipes won't feature regularly on Unbelievable. But you go on to say, listening to the interview that featured with Mark Driscoll, perhaps the problem, if it is a problem, is that preachers are not news in the UK, even in the Christian press. Now, you're referring here to his statement. He asked me during that interview, can you name one British male preacher who is sort of, you know, widely regarded, well known in the UK, and I struggled really to think of one, and he said it's because you don't have one. I agree with what you're saying, though. I think there is a very different kind of church culture in the UK, which just doesn't tend to focus as much on individual personalities necessarily. But if you want to listen to that again, it's all part of that New Year's Eve show from last week. Just a snippet, actually, of a much longer interview I took with Mark Driscoll, who is a sometimes controversial preacher from the US, pastor of Mars Hill Church in Seattle. But the full interview, if you like, will be appearing in the February edition of Christianity Magazine, which hits the shelf soon, actually, mid-January, if you're in the UK and can get hold of a copy. So check that out if you can, and we'll probably hear more from that interview a little later on in the year. Mark says, hi, Justin. Thoughts for Christmas. The festive season often feels like an uneasy blend of old pagan Saturnalia and the celebration of Jesus's birth. Atheist detractors like to dismiss the Christian Christmas as a cynical appropriation of pagan myths and legends. If Jesus truly is Creator God, then his birth is the one true archetype reflected throughout history. All of the myth and folklore are like colours in a stained glass window, with Jesus being the true white light shining through and being interpreted in different times and places. And something else to ponder. Astronomers speculate that the Bethlehem star was probably a conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn. What better symbol of Christmas could you have? The coming together of Saturnalian revelry and the planet of the king. Yes, well, obviously we heard the views of some of the guests we had on the show today who didn't feel that that worked, actually, as because it just didn't fit the date quite. And in a sense, the way it would have been wouldn't necessarily have cohered with with the kind of sign that the wise men would have needed. But anyway, thank you. It is one of the theories out there on the Bethlehem Star. You finish by saying, true Christmas was always meant to be a joyous celebration in light of the King of Kings coming amongst us. It foreshadows the completed heaven on earth condition towards which we are moving. Thank you very much, Mark. Good to hear from you. So let's hear some more of your emails now in regard to that show on Messianic prophecies. Michael Brown was our Messianic Jew, speaking with atheist Andrew Hindmarch about whether the prophecies of the Old Testament, if you like, give veridical evidence of the truth of Christianity, Jesus fulfilling these prophecies in a unique and special way. And if you'd like to email him, by the way, in regard to anything you've heard on today's show, you can do the same as many people have done this last week or two. Email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And I do try and respond in person to those who are emailing for the first time. I've got a few of those in the mailbag today. You can also, as ever, get in touch as well on the Twitter and Facebook accounts, where I'm usually posting up several times a week. So check those out as well, at UnbelievableJB on Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the Facebook page. Dale Glover says, I was unable to listen to the show last week due to holidays. Managed to catch up this week with both your recent shows. You were, in fact, you're right, Dale. You've asked me, was I the person who inspired you to do a show on Old Testament prophecies? You were. You got in touch a while ago asking if we could carry a show on this. So thank you for doing that. Please let Michael know I'm very appreciative of his hard work in this area specifically. I'm very familiar with his work on Messianic prophecies. And while I'm still not sure where I stand yet in terms of Christianity as a whole, I find the evidence from Messianic prophecies rather persuasive, to be honest, and that's largely part due to Michael's own research and his 5 books answering Jewish objections to Jesus, which I found to be extremely helpful in my own search. So I think that this area, as well as the historical evidence for the resurrection, as per Gary Habermas's minimal facts approach, are definitely 2 powerful areas in positive side in favour of Christianity's truth. But you go on to say one minor complaint would have to be the fact that I was hoping for a show more addressing the case for and against specific historical prophecies about specific nations which have been fulfilled in history. One that we're able to assess the significance of the prediction's fulfillment in relation to certain criteria for their validity, as God himself repeatedly declares this aspect to be the proof that the Jews, and I think it's reasonable for us today, to look for in order to verify the claims of the Bible that God had spoken directly through the prophets. And you suggest some more resources that we might turn to for that. Thank you, Dale. And yes, we certainly didn't exhaust the issue of prophecy just in that one about specifically the ones relating often to the Christmas story of Jesus's birth and birthplace, etc. So I'm sure there's room for doing something else again, but thanks for being part of the story as to how that show came about. Here's one, a couple, I'm running out of time already for emails, but just a couple of emails from new listeners, or at least people getting in touch for the first time. Jason says, as an atheist, I enjoy listening to your show to hear a different viewpoint. Many Christian shows I've tried to listen to seem to be preaching to the choir, though I admit that happens with many atheist shows, but you seem to give both sides a fair hearing. Now, my big question is, how can the universe be created for humanity? If you assume a godlike being created the universe, how would you divine its purposes or its likes and dislikes? And 3,000 or even 500 years ago, we thought that the earth was the whole of existence. If we take an impartial look at the universe we now know, we can come to 2 conclusions. First, God really likes nearly empty space. Second, he really likes stars. And you talk about the massive size of the universe and how ultimately, how can you be impartial and come to a conclusion that a planet the size effectively of a few pixels on your computer monitor is important to the creator? Certainly, I think we've heard this before in different ways. I suppose it's what Carl Sagan called the pale blue dot, you know. Why would we think we're particularly significant in the light of the massive universe we inhabit? But I think there are some good answers to this. I have emailed you back with one particular resource, Jason. But, you know, if you looked up the guys who featured today on Reasons to Believe, Hugh Ross, Jeff Swearink, they've got articles on this as well. Essentially, the fact that the size of the universe is a factor in why the universe needed to be a certain size in order to give it the timescale for life to develop. on Earth. Indeed, the rate of inflation and size of the universe are all those part of that finely tuned factors that allow life to develop in the first place. And so there may be good reasons why God would allow a universe to develop to such a size before life came to exist. But I hope that the resource I pointed you in the direction of is some help in that. You've also got questions on the evil God dilemma. Don't probably have time to go into that now. Jason, maybe try and read that out in another show. Thanks for getting in touch, though. First time emailer, Jason. Marja Hosking, also I think a first time emailer, says you've been actually listening to Unbelievable for about a year and a half, and during that period of time have listened to the full archive, some programs multiple times. I want to thank you for the excellent and groundbreaking program and all the hard work put into it and the enthusiasm and professionalism with which it's conducted. I can honestly say Unbelievable has educated me significantly in the field of apologetics and has opened up my horizons. Having become a fan of a number of your regular contributors, such as John Lennox, David Robertson, for whose recovery we prayed at home and are very happy to hear he's doing so much better, Peter Hitchens, Alistair McGrath, William Lane Craig, I followed up to some further resources and started also following other apologetic websites such as Reasons to Believe and Be Thinking. I am so grateful to Unbelievable for this. My husband's British, and having lived in Wales for 4 years, we now live in the beautiful Republic of Macedonia, my home country. Wishing you a very happy and blessed new year, both on a personal and professional level. Looking forward to another exciting, inspiring, educative and thought-provoking year with Unbelievable. Thank you, Marja. What a lovely email to respond to get, at least in my email. Thank you for listening to today's show. Hope you've enjoyed it. And I do hope you can join me again at the same time next week. We're going to be starting a series of programmes on the mind and soul theme that is across all our programming of Premier during January.
You're unbelievable.
And next week, we're going to be looking at the question of whether the mind is more than matter. We'll have Christian philosopher Keith Ward joining me on the programme, and he'll be arguing that our mind is more than matter. In fact, there's good evidence that we need a God in order to be able to understand the human mind. Well, opposite him will be atheist philosopher David Papineau, who says, ultimately, we're just made of matter, and that's all there is to it. We'll be hearing a fascinating discussion with those two on the mind-body philosophical issue at the same time next week. Hope you can join me for that. Justin Brierley here on the show that aims to get you thinking. Unbelievable.